Hi, this is Sukyun Lee, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby.
You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book, The Mind of the CEO, which looks at the future of the corporation, by Jeffrey E. Garton. Last show, we were looking at the chapter, The Biggest Blind Spot. Some CEOs support the proposition that they have obligations beyond managing their own companies, but they express these in personal and even somewhat casual terms, rather than as official corporate duties. Quote, I think that it is difficult for any business leader of a major company to ignore the governmental and social issues that confront not only the market, but the world at large, said Kenneth Chenault. And what will need to happen is that leaders will increasingly take a role in some form of change. Some will be focused on education, some on the environment, some on international affairs. I would say 10 years ago that it was more of a hobby. Now it's become a necessity and will thus become more so increasingly. I can look at having created value in the company so my shareholders are happy, Jorgen Schrimup mused, and I've come to the conclusion that it is important, but it's by far not all. I can also contribute to charity, $10,000 here, $10,000 there, that's simple. Taking my own time to help governments in Southern Africa and make a real contribution, as Jorgen Schrimup, not on official Daimler Chrysler business, and that's important to me. I take this part of the world. Others may take other parts. Some CEOs choose their words cautiously when it comes to anything approaching a too active role for business in the areas once dominated by government. In my interviews, I put one question this way, quote, do you think that in this market-oriented world, business leaders will play a more prominent and active role in proposing and designating regulations or in helping to strengthen existing institutions like the World Bank or even in establishing new ones? Rolf Brimmer of Deutsche Bank answered, quote, I couldn't agree more. That there's an obligation of business leaders to care for wider issues, he said. It is not enough, as maybe it was the case in post-World War II years, to concentrate on business only. He paused, and I felt that he had become uncomfortable. But in these days when business is really pushing policy and politicians, the discussions turn to who is driving who. That is the discussion which is on in Europe now. It is that business is driving politics, or is politics still in the driver's seat? And that is a very generous discussion because it goes towards the fundamentals of democracy. And there are limits, and I believe you have to observe them. Business is not the decision maker. Business leaders should take suggestions. They should give ideas. They should contribute everything they can. But in the final decision has to be taken by someone else, made by those who are accountable to the democratic process. Speaking to an audience at St. Anthony's College in Oxford in 1998, John Brown talked about BP's work in emerging markets, including Colombia, Russia, and China. Quote, "We'll work with local authorities and others to encourage innovation and investment in new business. We'll provide training. Our responsibility is to give the communities in which we are operating the chance and the time to make the transition in ways which do not destroy those communities. But I do want to stress the limits of the corporate role. Companies have no democratic legitimacy. It is not our role to make choices. Our role is to expand the range of choices available in ways that may be beyond the capacity of the public authorities." When the CEOs talked about their activities in the policymaking arena, I frequently detected a less than enthusiastic note. For example, Honeywell's Michel Bonsignor talked of the importance of trade associations as vehicles for CEO policy activity. But when pressed about their true effectiveness, he responded, quote, "I don't know if effective is the right word, but I keep thinking, where would we be if we didn't have them all?" Andrew Grove, the chairman of Intel, hesitated when I asked him what he thought about his company's social responsibility and involvement in public policy. Quote, "Actually, I'm ambivalent on this question," he said. "But ambivalence aside, we are getting more involved. We have spent over $100 million on science education, K-12 science and technology education, and that would have been unheard of 10 years ago. We have become much more involved in politics nationally and locally. There are two reasons. One is that we've become more enlightened, whatever the reason for that. And second, we've become bigger. 10 years ago, we were a $2 billion company. Today, we are a $30 billion company. Our impact on the communities we are in is proportionally much larger. Our potential impact on public policy should therefore be bigger. Our issues like taxation and immigration, well, we'd better talk on that subject and we'd better participate. We may not have the answers, but we do have a proper perspective." I asked Rupert Murdoch, chairman and CEO of the News Corporation, how he thought of the interaction of business and society. Having studied at Oxford, he started his career at 23 after inheriting 50% of a small newspaper in Adelaide, Australia. From there, he went on to buy a failing media group in Sydney, then on to England, where he fought his way into the cozy Fleet Street Club, the move that launched him on the path to becoming the world's best-known media mogul, owning, as he now does, the 20th Century Fox Studio, the Fox News Channel, the 23 television stations, newspapers, including the Times of London and the New York Post, satellite groups, including British Sky Broadcasting and Star TV in Asia, and publishing operations, including HarperCollins. We met in his New York office around a coffee table. In a soft voice that was difficult to hear, he spoke extremely slowly. Oftentimes, I thought he was finished speaking, and then, after a long pause, he continued, as if he were weighing every word. He said that, quote, "market rules," and that he felt virtually all CEOs, himself included, think about expanding their businesses with little or no concern for anything else. He cited his own experience in entering India. Quote, "We did it to build a business," he said. "There was no sense of mission or idealism to help or save India." He pointed to the Daimler Chrysler merger as another example. Quote, "There was a lot of talk about rationalizing the industry," he said. "But the motivation on both sides was clearly shareholder wealth and nothing more. It's dishonest to pretend otherwise." Murdoch's view of a company's responsibility rests on what happens after it enters a country. He believes that in the act of opening markets and bringing investment is itself an incalculable benefit. With regard to the media business itself, he gave Yale students a flavor for his thinking in early 1999 when he reflected on his long career. I think one thing I learned from my father is that the media, in the media, you must always be prepared to challenge the status quo and to participate and particularly challenge the elites. He talked about his experience of being a newspaper owner in England. It's not what we haven't made mistakes, he said. But one has to face it that when you are a catalyst for change, you're going to have enemies. The real point is that we are giving people choice. We are providing an alternative. And I hope we enrich society by doing that, he said. I asked Murdoch whether he and the leaders of other major concerns, Time Warner, Disney, had an overall vision of where this influential industry was going. I threw out an assumption that they were operating in an environment with virtually no global rules or standards, an idea that he did not dispute. He replied that there was no choice but to let the market take its course, to let the interplay of consumer demand and new technologies unfold in a competitive way, creating the landscape, the new rules, and the process. Government regulation, he felt, was one of the biggest potential problems on the horizon that could undermine all economic process and progress. There were many issues that I wanted to pursue, including his view on the standards for media content, but unfortunately we ran out of time. I was left with what he told Yale students in a lecture a few months before of our interview. Quote, "We follow public taste more than we lead it, which is nothing to boast about." George Soros, chairman of the Soros Fund Management, and perhaps the world's best-known global investor, has a skeptical view about the enhanced leadership role for CEOs. A Hungarian-born Jew, he survived Nazi invasion during his teenage years by posing as the godson of a Hungarian official. After the war, he moved to London, where he graduated from the London School of Economics. He came to the United States in the late 1950s and, beginning in 1969, ran one of the earliest and most successful investment funds to take advantage of developments in global markets. In 1992, Soros was alleged to have forced the devaluation of the British pound through shrewd speculation. Since then, financiers around the globe have watched his activities for clues about how markets would behave. Drawing conclusions from his behavior has not been easy, however, because he has played three roles simultaneously: private investor, public commentator, and global philanthropist. In the first, he moved markets with lightning strikes against weak currencies. In his policy pronouncements, he has bemoaned the lack of regulations for global markets. As a generous contributor to charities, he has supported causes from New York to Moscow. In a 1998 interview with Timothy O'Brien of the New York Times, he talked about his multiple roles. Quote, "We have to distinguish between playing by the rules and making the rules," Soros said. "Playing by the rules, one does the best one can, irrespective of the social consequences. Whereas in making the rules, people ought to be concerned with social consequences and not just with their personal interests. In other words, not to bend the rules to their benefit or advantage. This is a principle which I certainly have observed. I once saw firsthand how gingerly bankers could react to Soros's overlapping personas. The scene was the World Economic Conference in Davos, Switzerland, in late February 1998, and Soros was a participant in the private meeting of about 30 of the world's top financial figures. On and off during the session, he gave his views about global regulation, or the lack of it. At one point, he asked a technical question about how a particularly complicated transaction worked. The room went silent. Bankers' eyes shifted back and forth. You could sense what they were wondering. Why does he want to know this? What move is he planning next? On the subject of who bears the responsibility for leadership, Soros doubts that business executives can be counted on. Quote, I don't think that businessmen or civil society of any kind will be able to solve problems that we're currently confronting, he told me in his New York office. So we need government, and particularly we need to strengthen international institutions to deal with that. How is it going to happen? I have no answer. But I think it has to be political leadership because it's a political problem. So unless there is a politician or a statesman who can articulate the right policies and then get support, I don't think it's going to happen. Franklin Raines of Fannie Mae, reflecting on his experiences in government and private finance, drew a similar conclusion. He believes business ought to devote its attention almost solely on the mission of serving shareholders and customers, but that it must support a strong public framework which markets require to function. He worries that governments will levy too many requirements on business to perform social tasks, making those businesses uncompetitive and driving them to other countries. The only solution I see, he said, is you have to develop confidence in governments to run the social safety net, and the people in business will have to pay for that. And when business can go to do business, and government would not try to force upon them social missions, because if it does, ultimately capital will flee to other jurisdictions. The picture that emerges is a mixture of many views, including good intentions, concerns about pressures and the risks, carefully hedged willingness to expand the scope of leadership, and opinions that CEOs are not in a good position to lead outside the narrow orbit of their companies. Still, chief executives will have to do a better job of coming to grips with their roles in society, for serious problems threaten to engulf them.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you're listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
Every year, countless people succumb to the temptation to purchase exotic animals like hedgehogs, lizards, monkeys, even tigers and bears to keep as pets. But life in captivity is often a death sentence for these animals, who may suffer from malnutrition, an improper environment, and the stress of confinement. For more information on this issue, visit the BCSPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at the book, The Mind of the CEO, which is a look at the future of the corporation, written by Jeffrey E. Garten. And we're on the chapter, The Biggest Blind Spot. Business leaders are potential targets for a variety of frustrations relating to globalization and technical change. At a time when unprecedented prosperity masks glowing income inequalities, and when stock prices and CEO pay packages are sky high, while workers worry about their job security, there's a growing public angst concerning lopsided distribution of income. As local communities and national governments appear increasingly impotent in the face of vast mega-mergers and sudden movements of capital, all of which alter the location of production and jobs, more people are feeling that they have no one to whom they can voice their complaints. Who, after all, is in charge of the world economy? And how do you lodge a protest or register support in an effective way? Even today, with so much prosperity in the air, change and uncertainty have become disorienting. Public anxieties are at high levels. A Business Week Harris poll in the spring of the year 2000 found that most Americans believe that globalization drags down wages. A poll on Americans and globalization conducted at the same time by the University of Maryland concluded that a strong majority of U.S. public feels that trade policies haven't adequately addressed the concerns of American workers, international labor standards, or the environment. In early May 2000, a Wall Street Journal NBC poll showed that 48% of Americans thought that trade harmed the economy, compared to 34% who thought that it helped. In August 2000, a Business Week Harris poll indicated that 72% of Americans feel that business is too much influence. Two-thirds of the population believe that big companies place profits over safe, reliable, quality products for consumers. All of these worries are aggravated by a sense that the phenomenal technological developments we're seeing is beyond our control, not just in communications, but also in genetic engineering and robotics. Even an establishment figure like Bill Joy, chief scientist for Sun Microsystems, says that we're being propelled into this new century with no plan, no control, no brakes, says Gene Sperling, head of the President Clinton's National Economic Council. Despite the growth in our economy, despite the record unemployment, you see nothing but increased anxiety about globalization, technology, and trade. It's pervasive everywhere. A number of public policy problems are piling up too, all involving high-stakes corporate interests. They include the debate over taxation of the internet, the digital divide at home and abroad, international rules to prevent global monopolies, protection of international property rights around the world, a framework to balance science and morality in the biotech revolution, the delivery of affordable health care, the security of pensions for aging populations, not to mention such threats as the growth of global crime syndicates and the spread of infectious diseases in the areas where people are too poor to buy medicine. We haven't been in such a state since the early part of the last century, when a set of decisions shaped the relationship between the industrialized economy and the government for decades to come, wrote Bob Davis and Gerald Sieb in the Wall Street Journal. Finally, whatever the situation today, many trends point to much more pressure on the workforce in industrial societies, as jobs will shift to developing countries in magnitudes never before contemplated. One reason is that the internet will not only help companies find partners, but will help them train and integrate foreign workers into their central operations. Years ago, American European firms began to move parts of their back offices to the Caribbean, or India, for example, but we've seen just the beginning of the transfer. All of this will be happening at a time when a more efficient use of the internet will allow big companies in the United States, Europe, and Japan to do more work with fewer people. In developing countries, the new jobs will, of course, be welcome. However, the digital divide that separates those who take advantage of modern information technology and those who cannot is likely to get wider before it narrows. The reason is that those who can afford computers or cell phones will be able to exploit the new opportunities that are continuously offered, whereas people who live on a dollar or less a day and who have never made a phone call in their lives have priorities that come before logging on. So the poor and less skilled people will fall still further behind, all the more so given the pace of progress at the present time. Unfortunately, political leaders are increasingly leaving the resolution of social and governance problems to markets and the private sector. The rhetoric from government officials may not indicate a reliance on business because it wouldn't be good politics, but it would watch what public officials do rather than what they say. Most analysts agree that there's no longer any meaningful debate between the right and the left. Nearly everyone is trying to reduce the size and scope of government. Nearly everyone is pro-market and looking for ways to attract more private capital, more technology, and more management. While no one can predict how long this trend will last, the momentum is strong. Global markets are forcing governments to rein in spending or face debilitating interest rates on their borrowing. And they are pressing governments to eliminate regulatory red tape or face loss of government of foreign investment. At the same time, political leaders see in the private sector the resources they need to do their job, whether it's building infrastructure or shoring up the social safety net. The expectations that companies will deliver such services are bound to be dashed. Then CEOs may well become the scapegoats for the failure of the public sector to handle its increasingly complex political and economic problems. Alongside the unrealistic expectation that companies will fill the vacuum left by the inadequacies of governments, there's a growing campaign by activist groups to highlight what is being done badly by the private sector, or simply not being done at all. The activist non-government organizations, known generally as NGOs, have discovered that they can band together and direct public attention to a variety of problems that they say are caused by corporate irresponsibility or globalization or both. Most of these NGOs are defining globalization as a Bosnia for global companies and a disaster for everyone else. It would be a mistake to think that the new protest movements as ethereal. In recent years, NGOs have mustered the clout to change the policies of companies like Nike on its treatment of workers abroad, Monsanto on genetically engineered food, Royal Dutch Shell on environmental problems, and Starbucks on prices it pays to third world farmers. Because they're often on the political correct side of these questions, who is against a cleaner environment or less exploitation of poor workers? NGOs have achieved legitimacy in the eyes of a good deal of the public. They have skillfully exploited the void between shrinking governments, unable to cushion the impact of change on ordinary citizens, and multinational companies that are seen as the agents of that change. NGOs have gained influence by joining forces across borders, aggregating power under umbrella groups such as the Consumers International and building alliances with unions such as the AFL-CIO. They have harnessed the internet to form global coalitions and coordinate lobbying in multiple national capitals. While governments and CEOs bore the public and media with sterile abstractions about free markets, NGOs tap into the anxieties of local communities around the world. Their effectiveness is enhanced by their unconventional organizational structure, which has no central leadership and only shifting coalitions, making it a difficult movement to counteract. In short, the NGOs have now become a powerful new force in the world scene. We're going to continue looking at this book in next shows and following this argument, so please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby.